split me apart.
Welcome to ITE 1, Module 16.
I think he was jumping in there because I was cracking up. But anyway, thank you, Gary. All right, so Module 16, and we have talked about it in an earlier module, is types of attacks that threaten the security of computers and their data. Also,
yeah, it's called the end user.
Yeah, often that's right, yeah. So we're going to be talking about developing security plans, troubleshooting security, looking. And I know that we did do some on this, but I think that Module 16 is a little bit more sort of reiteration. So,
and it's very important because IT people will maintain and improve their jobs by doing this properly, and they'll lose them by not doing it.
Hmm. So first off, we were talking about security policies and each of the environments that you'll find if you're a network administrator, you're going to have to be following a security policy of the organisation that you're working with. So when if you're creating a security policy, you'd be looking at where the computer's going to be used, okay? Whether they're in a high threat area, is there full-time internet access, those type of questions, whether the computers have got firewalls, antivirus, or is it a laptop computer. So you're going to be looking at all those options, including, I might say too, is looking at things such as physical security too.
This is called risk assessment.
Mm-hmm. Store laptops in, whether you've got cable locks, all those types of things you need when you're looking at security or developing a security policy. It's just a set of guidelines that contain checklists, and you're using those rules and guidelines to develop your policy and to have a standard of policy. So it's just, if you wanted to summarise what it is, I guess it's a definition of the acceptable computer usage statement for the organisation that you are working for. And that would include things like who or who isn't allowed to use the computer equipment, how many permissions they've got, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm
not going to speak.
Okay, I was leaning back a little, so. okay, and oftentimes you'll find too that in organisations that you actually, when you start there as an employee, you actually have to sign a security agreement with the company, and you won't get a job if they don't let you, if you don't sign it. So basically, things like confidentiality issues, all of those come into security policy. I think they definitely have one here, don't they, Trev? Yeah, and all staff have to sign the security policy.
It also pays to read the security policy before you sign it, so that when you get fired for looking for another job on the company network, you'll know what happened.
Okay, another thing that you would have in your security policy would be things like what happens if there is a breach in security. Who to contact in an emergency, things that you're allowed to share and things that you aren't. All right, and certainly emergency use. So the security policy needs to show or identify what type of hardware and equipment that's being used, and to stop theft particularly and data loss. Restricting access to the premises, and the most buildings these days have got any sort of data that is of a confidential nature, or they just don't want things stolen, are going to have security restrictions in place. A lot of places use card access, others use fingerprint technology, some of the really highfalutin ones use retinal scanning type materials. Be good for the ones.
People
without retinas, eh?
You can scan my artificial eye. It looks pretty good.
Be interesting, wouldn't it? Hang on,
it looks better than my real eye.
Well, we know somebody was born without retinas. Scanners.
Yeah, and they're going to have a great deal of time getting into the corporate data centre, aren't they?
Other ways of sort of protecting your infrastructure, like your all your equipment, is securing, you know, putting, say, your vital equipment into secured rooms, having wireless detection measures in place, using firewalls, all those types of things. Also, when you're talking, as I mentioned earlier, about laptops, cable locks, having cases that lock, or certainly having a locking door on the area that you're keeping your computers in. I'm just scanning down here. When you're making your security policy, you also need to look at things like, as I mentioned, how is the equipment going to be used, where you're going to have the computers, and what user access is needed. So if you've got, say, your computers in a very public area, you're going to need to protect them pretty much from being stolen. If you're in a secure environment, of course, your security measures aren't going to need be quite as strict. Anyone would like to mention to me some other, like, software measures that you can use to protect network devices? Things like firewalls, I was thinking.
I was wondering about that. I was wondering how many personal firewalls get installed on corporate PCs these days. Back when I was in corporate, none.
Yeah.
I suppose it is different now. And they were relying, you know, very heavily on whatever was happening at the gateway with the network administrators and stuff.
And there's a number of software applications that you can have, you know, that are going to protect your computer from malicious code. Things like spyware protection. Anyone remember back in our last module that we did on this, some of the other forms of malicious computer code?
Yeah, there's malware, greyware, spyware, underwear.
Trojan horses? Sorry, I'm still not in the chat room. I think a snail had beat me in there.
Yeah, there's actually three snails in there already.
No, I can't log in and help you do it.
Thanks, Gary.
No, it's all right. I'm just joking. That's okay. Don't worry about it too much, this lesson. I'm sure Elise will sort you out later and you can have a listen to a shot of how to get into the chat window later.
I think I have seen the idea.
Sorry about this, Kerry.
No, you're right. We're not worried. There's still a lot of lecture before we get to the quiz.
Okay, so basically in the home environment, you know, you're connecting sort of straight into the internet, and rather than actually using a local area network that's, you know, most of the corporate environments use. Kerry has left.
Yeah, my Thunderbird is stuck in a loop.
Oh, okay. His Thunderbird stuck in a loop. Okay. Yeah, so, and also, as you mentioned, Elise, I think it was, that you can have in a corporate environment, a lot of the protection is on the server side, because you can't really rely on all the employees to keep all their security up to date either. But certainly making a security policy gives you and your organisation a guide that you can actually discuss with your new employees, or, you know, the current employees from time to time, making sure they know it. Some of the security devices that you have on a network, things like using passwords to access the network, and also using event logging, you know, so you auditing and monitoring all your activity on the network. So people know exactly who's doing what. What your wireless connections would be an area that is pretty vulnerable to attack. So you would be using things like encryption to encrypt data. And encryption technology just uses It's used to encode the data that so that it's non-readable. Hash encoding or hashing ensures that your messages aren't corrupted or tampered with while they're being transmitted. And it actually does that by a mathematical formula that creates a numeric value, and that is unique to that data. So if one, for example, even one character was changed, the function output or the digest, message digest, wouldn't be the same. And so the function is actually one way. So knowing the message digest doesn't necessarily allow an attacker to recreate that message. So that makes it difficult for someone to intercept and to change the messages. Some of the popular hashing algorithms are SHA and MD5. There's also symmetric encryption. So in symmetric encryption, you need both sides of an encrypted conversation to use an encryption key to be able to encode and decode the data. And it requires also that the sender and the receiver need to use identical keys. With asymmetric encryption, that requires two keys, and in that case you have a private key and a public key. So the private key is needed for writing a public message, and a public key is needed to decode the message. And the advantage of asymmetric encryption is that only the private key needs to be kept secret, and you can have public keys distributed openly by email or by posting them on the web, for example. With regard to virtual private networks, and you may have come across this terminology before, VPN, it uses encryption to secure the data as if it was travelling in a private corporate local area network. And it does that even though their data actually travels over any network. The secure data pipelines between the points in the VPN we refer to as secure tunnels. Do you want to say anything there, Kerry?
I'm still rebooting.
Oh, sorry. He's still rebooting. I thought you were back on. All right, we'll hear from Kerry a little bit later. Okay, computer equipment and data can also be secured using overlapping protection techniques, and that prevents anybody sort of unauthorized getting access to any data that you've got. So, for example, overlapping protection is using two different techniques to protect an asset, so they're actually overlapping, as the name implies. So we refer to that as two-factor security. So when you're considering any security program, things you'd have to think about are the cost of the implementation as opposed to the value of the data or the equipment that you want to protect. Okay, as regards the physical security, we use security hardware, and that helps prevent security breaches and loss of data or your equipment. And we're thinking there things like locks, so the would be the most common thing we think of is locking an area so that your physical equipment is safe. You can have conduits where you've got a casing that protects your infrastructure media from damage and also from unauthorized access. As I mentioned earlier, things like card keys, they're good because if you've got, say, for example, I lost my building access card to work a while back, and they just deactivated that card till I went and got another one. So but it is a more expensive option. Another thing that's used a lot is video surveillance. So people have, for example, you often go into shops and that, and you actually have video surveillance there that's monitoring all the activity. And I guess the other one would be the human side, where you've got actual security guards who are keeping an eye on a shop or a bank or whatever the case may be. When you've got security, it's usually things like video and that type of thing, it's usually put up fairly high and in a fairly obscure or unobvious point, although some places I note are having that type of equipment put very loudly and proudly displayed so that it deters
I don't know about Perth, but JB Hi-Fi in Melbourne have security guards, I think, on just about every JB I've been in.
Do they really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, the one in Chadston does, and I think the one at Ringwood used to. There's a security guy, and he'll, when you walk out of the shop, he'll get your bag of your goodies, and he'll make it, he'll put something on it to prove that you've actually walked out of the shop legitimately with it. Because I think you have to also show him the receipt on the way out, too. That's what happened to me.
Okay.
But you're right about the loud.
Show him your receipt and your goodies, and your goodies have to have the secure seal on the bag. All the electricals and everything they keep in cupboards, and only the guys that work, you know, the salespeople have got the keys around their neck for the cupboards, so they actually have to pull everything out of the cupboards to show you. And those display units they put back in the cupboard, and then they have to go to another cupboard and get the box out of the cupboard, and then they give it to the people at the counter. You go around to the counter and pay, and only then do they give you your goods.
Wonder if they had a problem with shoplifting.
We must have. No, it was a bit like that when I bought my headphones and the set of speakers for the... Well, they're actually computer speakers, but, oh, yeah, it was a bloody rigmarole that was.
As I brought up earlier, too, about, like, fingerprint technology and retinal scanning, that type of physical information that is told about the person that's there is called biometrics, and that may be something that'll come up in your exam, so... if you haven't heard that term before, that's what we're referring to. Other types of security, when we're talking about data security, so you need to authenticate access, and oftentimes that's not just one way of identifying them. There might be twofold, threefold ways of identifying that person. Might be photo ID, might be used little memory chips on a smart card. So say for example a smart card is it stores data, and the internal memory has an embedded integrated circuit chip, and that connects to a reader that either directly or through a wireless connection. So they're used a lot in things like ID badges, other types of online authentication, and for secure credit card payments. You may have noticed with your credit cards now, most of them have got a little security chip in them.
Yes.
Another type you can have is a security key fob, and that's just a small little device, and it's a little bit like a key ring, and it's got a small radio system that communicates with the computer. But it's only over a short range, and it's small enough so that people can attach it to the key ring, and then the computer needs to sense the signal from the key fob before it will accept the person's username or password. Okay, and the level of security is really going to be determined by the sort of type of data that you want to, or the type of physical equipment that you want to protect. Okay, I mentioned briefly there two-factor security. That's always a good thing, is having more than one type of security. So you might have passwords, you might have your smart card or biometric card, scanning, and that's going to give you a much better level of protection. Okay. As I mentioned before, the hardware and software types of protection that we have, there's a number of varieties of them. So firewalls, for example, they're going to protect your data and equipment on a network from being unauthorised, from anyone unauthorised getting into them. So it should be used, a firewall should be used in addition to your antivirus and those types of things. They have we have hardware and software firewalls that have a number of different modes for filtering your network data traffic. There's the packet filter, and the packet filter is set of rules that allows or denies traffic, and it's based on criteria such as your IP address or other protocols or ports that are being used. So also, my dog is snoring in the background here. I can hear her quite loudly.
I was wondering what that was.
It's Topaz.
I thought there was this road noise from an adjacent road or noise. And
no,
I haven't heard that
from
Geraldine's microphone before.
No, it's the dog. She's quite loud. Okay. Try to keep a straight face and your dog snoring away underneath. I'm glad I'm so interesting, Topaz.
Yeah, I'm glad she's not doing the course. She might fail. She's slept through all the lectures.
Yes, she has. She's just taking it in. You know how you take it in when you're asleep? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
But she's not telling, all right? She's not going to tell anybody what she knows.
Can't she sit my final exam for me?
I don't know. Depends how much you pay her. Okay.
Okay, it's like that, is it?
There's also a proxy firewall, and that actually inspects all the traffic. And again, it allows or denies packets, and it's based on a set of configured rules. So your proxy firewall acts as a gateway, and it protects your computers that are actually inside or within the network. Stateful packet inspection, it's a firewall that keeps track of the state of the network connections that are travelling through the firewall. And in this case, the packets are not part of a known connection, are not allowed back through the firewall. Now, when we're talking a hardware firewall, it's actually a physical filtering component that inspects your data packets from the network before they reach the computers that are on that network. And they are often installed on routers, so your hardware firewall is a freestanding unit that doesn't use the resources of the computers it's looking after or protecting. So you don't have any effects on performance and that type of thing. When we're talking software firewalls, that obviously, as it sounds, an application that's actually on the computer, and it inspects and filters the data packets. And we all know the old wonderful Windows firewall. And that's a firewall that's actually included with your Windows operating
Windows
system.
Windows 3.1 didn't have a firewall.
Windows 3.1 didn't, neither did any of them, really, up until XP.
Yeah, Windows XP firewall. Now I was asleep, but I picked up on that one.
XP Service Pack 2, even.
Actually, to be precise, yes. Service Pack 2, XP didn't have it before then.
So your software firewall uses the resources of your computers, so they can have an impact on the performance. So
it's actually a gotcha for people who have USB and ADSL modems. So he's awake again and he's talking. If you've got a USB modem that's patched directly into your computer and you have your phone line hooked into the other side and no firewall, say goodbye to anything that's on your computer because the internet is coming into your lounge room. And there are a lot of ISPs that will sell you a single port ADSL modem, wire it straight in via USB or straight into an Ethernet port and assign your external IP to the computer. And that's the end of your software security, so make sure your external defences are working. And Trevor's phone's ringing again. As they say in Star Trek, Star Trek shields up, Mr. Chekhov.
Pretty much, yeah, because in that respect, there's no shields up for Mr. Chekhov. There's no more Mr. Chekhov.
Yes, that's right. He will not be firing photon torpedoes.
So if we're talking about the costs of different types of protection, firewalls would be the cheapest. Then another solution would be biometrics, and then the dearest is actually key cards, which is surprising to me because I always thought that the biometrics would be the most expensive.
Well, that's changing now because they're actually putting fingerprint sensors on everything because it looks funky. Like, most of your new laptops have got fingerprint sensors and stuff on them.
Yeah, they have.
And interestingly enough, I know they're talking about network security here. They haven't made any mention of antivirus and the other stuff yet.
Yeah, only briefly, yeah.
I just thought of something funny. I'm just waiting. I'm just waiting to hear the Cretan Affair or, you know, This Day Will Fight story on blind person tries to gain access to corporate data center to do his job, but was prevented by the biometrics eye scanner.
On Today Tonight, eye scanners, are they discriminatory? Find out. And after the break...
Find out after the break.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they've got to have a... You're right, there's got to be a... in the middle.
After the break, find out six more ways you too can lose weight.
Oh, and then... And finally, a woman who picked up $4,000 off a suburban street. We'll exchange three words with her.
You can't forget the bodgy builder, the bodgy tenant, the bodgy landlord, and the dodgy kid who wants to do something at school.
And for those of you in India who are absolutely mystified by what we are going on about, we're taking up our local current affairs
tabloid programs. Current affairs shows, we call it.
Yes, Today, Tonight, and A Current Affair.
Current Affair. As we often say, This Day We'll Fight and A Cretan Affair.
Exactly. We're not talking about this, we're moving on. Geraldine's got a lot more to go through. I don't care whether he owns six shoe shops or whether his feet fell off. Let's continue.
But we will. I didn't see it, George, and we will talk about it after lecture if you wish. Okay. Often with regard to things like security errors, they're caused by incorrect permissions on your folders and files, or incorrect configuration of your wireless security. So the level of permissions for your files and folders, the levels are configured to limit the individual or the group user access to specific areas of data. And both FAT and NTFS allow folder sharing, and they also allow folder level permissions for users with network access.
However, they are only network-based permissions, not file-level permissions on FAT. And that's an important difference.
My next sentence was the additional security of file-level permission is provided only with NTFS. Okay. See, wireless...
And other file systems.
When we're configuring wireless security, the wired equivalent privacy, or WEP, as we often or mostly refer to it, it actually encrypts the broadcast data between the wireless access point and whoever is using, and it uses a 64-bit or 128-bit encryption key.
Which are actually a 40-bit or 104-bit encryption key, because they actually throw away a few bits and set them based on parity. I hope we are going to go and talk about Wi-Fi protected access in a minute, because if you're still using WEP, you better have some very good reasons or a braille note.
And my next sentence is Wi-Fi protected access. Uses better encryption and authentication than does WEP.
And keep in mind that WPA2, which is even better than WPA, actually doesn't have the same problem with the initial vectors that WPA has. In fact, WPA was a bodgy that was put together to try and save people from the inadequacies of WEP, and in that particular instance it failed. It's only slightly slower to pull out a WPA key than it is to pull out a WEP key. And we won't be discussing how you do that on open lecture, but let's just say that aircrack-ng.org is quite educational.
Okay, then there's MAC address filtering, and that restricts computer access to a wireless, and that's going to help prevent, say, the casual user from accessing the network. It is vulnerable though, so should, when used alone, should be combined with another security filter. The service set identifier, or SSID, broadcasting on the wireless network, you have SSID broadcasts the identity of your network. So if you turn off the SSID, it makes the network seem to disappear.
Unless, of course, one single computer in your house access it, and then every single sniffer within a 300-metre radius will pick up your network. So it's another one that you should not be using alone. Just because you've hidden your ESSID, you've only just stopped people from scanning for your network. You certainly won't stop people from discovering it. It'll take about 2 seconds and a copy of Kismet.
I have a question.
Mm.
Once you've hidden it, and I've never connected to one that is hidden because I just haven't tried, how do you, like, do you, you know, in that little usual dialogue when you connect to a wireless network in Windows, then you look for the ID and you go, yeah, connect to this network and so on, how do you access it if it's not broadcasting?
You actually don't actually pull it out of the list. You've actually got to add the network in by hand and type in the ESS ID.
So you actually have to know the ESS ID.
Or have a copy of Kismet and watch somebody communicate with the access point, because as soon as one station communicates with the access point, it'll decloak the network and tell you what it's called.
Cool.
All right, now I'm going to go through a few different types of permissions, and I'm just going to see if anybody can tell me what they actually do. If you have a read-only permission, can you tell me what you would, what that implies?
Sorry, Jeremy, I missed that. I was chasing a phone that fell on the floor.
Ah, I'm just talking about file permissions. So I was just saying I'm going to go through and ask you guys some questions. If you had a read-only file, what attributes does that allow you to do, or what does it allow you to do?
Read-only, you can only read the file, but you can't change it.
That's it. Good one. Okay, if you had a write permission...
It means you can write to the file, you can change it and delete it.
You can also read it? Like, can you... you can write and...
No.
Can you?
No. No, if you only have write permission... If, yeah, she said, can you read and write? No, if you only have write permission on a file, you can only change it. It doesn't guarantee that you can read it. You have to have read and write to be able to read the file.
Yeah.
Okay. Uh-huh. The next one
is that in
read...
both Windows and Linux?
Yes, it is. And in fact, if a good reason why there are a lot of people who under Linux set their /pub/incoming directory to write only so that you can't see what other people are putting into pub incoming.
Okay, sure.
Okay, the next one is read and execute. I shall read and then I shall execute you. What does that mean?
Means you can run the file and... Yeah, run the program that the file actually is. Oh, and
Redis. And on a directory, it means you can change into that directory.
Yeah, in Linux, yeah.
Under Linux, yes.
Yes,
under NT,
that's
actually called the change permission, which I'm just about to shoot down, but yeah.
Change permission. Yes, I've done that once. I've taken the executable attribute off a directory under Linux and no one could get into it.
Okay, what about a permission of modify? No?
I think that's as the name suggests. I haven't seen it in Linux, but I think I have seen that attribute under NTFS, and I think it really just means you can... The system will let you open the file, write to the file to modify it, but it won't let you delete it.
Oh, no, it actually allows you to modify and delete the file. Okay. Also allows all the actions permitted by the write permission and the read and execute permission. So it will let you delete it.
So really, it's just a fancy way of saying those three things, is it? I was going to say, what's the point of having it there?
Because you have write permission means you can actually make modifications to a file, but you can't actually delete it. And there are times when you'd want to be able to modify a file and not actually have it deleted, whereas the modify permission does also give you the ability to delete the file. Basically, NT permissions are based on a POSIX standard for access control lists, 1003.1, and it's an absolute mess. And in fact, there are various rules that say which permissions do what over other permissions. For example, full control supersedes any other permission, but then there are other reasons, there are other semantics and hierarchies. And one of the things that you will learn about in your first 5 minutes of NT administration is a command utility called CACLS, CACLS, which will allow you to fix the permissions that you just messed up with the GUI.
Is that available to XP administratory topics?
It certainly is, yes.
So, I might have a look at that. I assume it runs in a DOS box, does it?
Yes, it does, and I'll just see if it's here by default. Yes, it's there by default.
I'll have a look at it later. Yes, because it's as you say, it's not hard to muck these things up with the GUI.
Especially if you accidentally click the button that says apply this permission to folders and subfolders without actually thinking, or you've set the wrong set of permissions, you can actually lock yourself out of things quite nastily. And NT, for example, doesn't enjoy it when you take read permission off the registry.
No.
Okay, you all did quite well on those, actually.
Just to tell you a quick funny story, my former hosting company, who runs a Windows NT, a Windows 2003 server, was trying to cover up a security breach that caused all the websites to be defaced and hacked 2 years ago. So his answer was, after backing it up, is to reset the permissions at the top of the tree, and he didn't do it right. And he went out for the afternoon, and every website on that server, as the permissions went down the tree through all the reseller accounts and the websites and the files in the websites, disappeared from the internet.
Oh joy.
And we had to wait for him to come home to fix it.
And this is something that's very worth considering. If you're going to make a global permissions change, know exactly what you are doing, because there could be important permission settings that are actually further down the tree that you don't know about or that you haven't considered. And taking permissions and doing a blanket permission change is a very dangerous option, and you'd better know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we had a raft of unhappy customers those few days. I can tell you that after that little stunt.
If you would like to have a look at files that do have interesting file permissions under Windows XP, and if you break it, you keep both pieces, the System Volume Information folder is an interesting one, because normal users do not have read permission on there.
Well, of course, yeah. I'll have a look at it later.
Earlier I touched on firewalls just briefly, and they work generally by opening and closing the ports that your applications use. So by only opening the required ports on a firewall, you're allowing like a restrictive security policy. So any packet that's not explicitly permitted is then denied. And some of the firewalls you'll see will ask you, whether to allow or deny when you're opening different programs.
Which is an interesting point, because in the first 2 days of having your firewall software installed, most users will turn it off because it asks them too many questions, or they don't know the answers to the questions that it asks them.
Well, they accidentally hit block always, block permanent, and take themselves off the net.
Yep, seen that too.
Yeah, I've had a few of those calls. I can't get my websites anymore. Did you see a dialog box? Yeah, but I clicked block all. And I said, yeah, I uninstalled your software.
The flip side of that is where you've got a permissive type of security policy, and that's going to allow sort of access through all the ports unless you're actually explicitly denying them. A lot of people using different types of firewalls, mostly the software firewalls and an application that's run on your computer that's actually being protected. They can be an add-on or they can be part of the operating system. And there's a number of different sort of third-party firewalls that are around. And then if you were, say, for example, configuring the XP, Windows XP firewall, if you think about some of the setting there, like the automatically, when you get that, you'll be prompted whether you want to unblock or keep blocking. I think there's another option there too that's asked me later.
And, which is probably in about 3 milliseconds when the next packet goes through.
And you've really got to sort of know what you're doing with them.
I think it was unblock, unblock now, and completely block.
Yeah.
Because you can let through this one.
You can manage your security settings manually and add the program or ports that are needed for your applications. If you wanted to add a program, you go through the control panel, start control panel, I think the security center.
To the Windows firewall, because the security center is a BRTCH basically.
I recommend this to all of my people. and I don't recommend it to people on class here, but I usually stop the security center service because I get sick and tired of those stupid balloons popping up going, your antivirus is out of date, your firewall was about to attack your friend's cat and throw it over the fence.
Well, your firewall's turned off because you've got it turned off because you can't use Dreamweaver and sleeping on it.
Oh, yeah!
That's right. Thank you, George.
We've got a cat here that I wish somebody would throw over the fence, actually.
I'll just throw it at the Windows firewall, it'll get hit over the head, well and truly.
We had a friend who believed that the best thing for a cat was to be dropped into a bucket of water with a phone book on the top, but...
Oh, poor Putty, you can't do that.
Poor Putty cat. Okay.
Get your head up for cruelty, Kerry.
He would be. He's never actually done it. He just dreams about it. He doesn't like cats very much.
He's a man after my own heart.
I like cats. I like cats.
Putty cats are good.
They're nice fried.
They're a confounded nuisance.
Cats in the kettle at the peaking moon.
Okay, back to lecture, and we can share that audio file around later.
That is certainly a wicked laugh, Elise.
Oh, okay. Sure, I'll have it. Ask him to play it to you.
I mentioned earlier malware, and that's malicious software that's installed on a computer without the knowledge or your permission. There are things like types of malware, such as spyware, phishing attacks, and they collect data about you, the person using the computer, and that can be used to gain information, confidential information, from your computer. It's important,
like your internet banking password.
Important to run virus and spyware scanning programs, and they help you to clean up or detect first off and then clean up any of those nasties. Okay, virus protection programs typically run automatically. You can certainly run them manually as well, and they run in the background and monitor for, look for any problems that are there.
And if they're Norton, they slow your system to a screeching halt and then don't detect anything anyway.
You get a warning balloon that pops up if there is a virus.
Your computer has slowed up.
Anti-spyware programs, just to reiterate on these, they scan for keyloggers and for other malware, and then they help you to remove those programs from your computer. Anti-adware programs look for programs that display advertising on your computer. And if you've ever been hit by an ad attack, look out. Anti-phishing programs block the IP addresses of known phishing websites and warn you about suspicious websites.
And if you're not careful, they can really get in the way. For example, the new versions of AVG 8 will look at all of the search results that you get back from Google, and then they'll put a little icon next to them to tell you whether it thinks they're safe or not. Well, that's very nice of it, but I wish it would just leave my Google page alone. So be warned about AVGH.
Okay, because I put that on my auntie's computer the other night because it was free. I better check that out before she gets her hands on it then. Thank you for the warning.
It's not inaccessible, it's just that it says safe or unknown next to all the Google links, and it looks at pages that you pull up through search engines and stuff, so it does make modifications to the HTML on the way through.
Can we disable it?
I don't believe you can in the free version. I think that's what you pay for.
Well, you certainly can't do anything in AVG 3.8 because there's an interaction between JAWS and the interface.
They've fixed that in the latest service release, and if you do actually want to access the interface with JAWS, it's a bit of a kludge. You can close JAWS down, pull up the AVG interface, and then relaunch JAWS, and it goes like a mad thing.
Oh, wow.
Okay, great. I'm going to say that's going to be fantastic. I think I'll be remoting it for my auntie. I don't think she'll be doing that.
A lot of people have gone for free AV, which tends to work fairly well, and that sort of thing. So, it's a tricky one to find a good antivirus thing.
Yeah, because for a while we were using AVG. Anyway, that's all beside the point. It was one of those late nights we were talking on Skype, and I think you disappeared, Kerry. I might have asked you.
Yeah, it's no problem. Oh, look, I don't even have a valid answer to the question, to be honest. Avast has been known to chew up a lot of system resources on certain people's configurations, so your mileage may vary. Some people love it, other people hate it, but the same thing goes for AVG. It's really up to the individual person what they want to install.
Okay. The operating system is very likely to be the target of any attacks, and in that way people who are launching that attack can control your computer. And if it is then, you know, they've got control, they can get into all sorts of things and you're in real strife. So they can... one popular way is to turn the targeted computer into spam generators, and they launch attacking emails without you being able to stop them. So we call computers that are affected that way zombies. Okay, Windows XP automatically downloads and installs updates to the operating system by default. Obviously, that's not always the best way to do things, because you might find that the updates conflict with your security policy of your organisation or with the settings that are on particular computers. And also, you might want to be testing updates before you're allowing them. So you can have what options there. There's the automatic one, which we just spoke about, and that allows the download and also installs the updates without you having to do anything. The next one is only download updates, and obviously that's as it sounds. It downloads the updates automatically, but you are then prompted then to install them. Next option you can have is Notify Me, which notifies you that the updates are available and gives you the option to when or if you download and install them. And the other option you had is to...
Hello?
Sorry? Oh, sorry, I'm being lost again. I've been lost again. Oh, dear.
Let me go.
I'll get closer. Sue said she should let me go. Oh, they're not nice to me here. Okay. Yeah, I know. I'm feeling very sad.
On the count of three, students. 1, 2, 3.
Oh. Yeah!
I feel so loved. Little song. Yeah, watch out or I'll sing to you all again. Okay. You need to make sure... a romantic song. Oh, dear. I don't know one. Okay. Where was I? Windows update setting needs to be configured to notify you of available updates, or either that or just turn it off and then check it manually. Yeah.
I think notify is good because at least it tells you that there are updates available. If you turn it off, you may never know that there's something that's come out.
Yeah, and you can do it off, sometimes don't turn it off and you forget to turn it back on and you forget to check it. Next thing you know, 3 months has gone by.
It does, yeah, it does warn you each time a new update is out. And yes, admittedly, there is a balloon that goes... But you can just hit the control key and get on with
your life. Yeah, it's good. It was good. I walked past my friend's computer that I've got Jaws running on, and the other day, and it just said, updates are available for my computer, but I didn't have to do anything because I've just got it set to that third option.
Yeah, which is how I have mine set to... Okay, now, sometimes when you're a network administrator, you might have to be setting up temporary access for people, you know, where you're giving temporary permissions, so you can set up a short-term or temporary account. In that case, you would be limiting the areas that you're allowing them access to. Another possible area, though, when security can become a factor is when somebody is actually leaving an organisation. So you'd be actually terminating their permissions as soon as they'd left, you know. And it's probably mostly the case, the employee or former employee has stored their files in a personal space on the server, you would be needing to eliminate access by disabling the account. You could at a later stage restore files if you've got somebody else that's taken over that job, and you also sometimes the employer comes back and they can have access re-enabled. So there are also the opportunity to make guest accounts, and that would be where you've got someone obviously coming in short term and they need access to, say, the internet or email. And to do that, you can actually put them in an area called a guest account. Yes.
Yes, hello, hello, and which will be somebody from Enable, I would wager. What's not working? Ah, well, it was working a minute ago.
I think they're saying their connection's dropping out.
Yeah, unfortunately, the internet connectivity isn't too good over there.
Okay.
Just a bit of trivia in relation to what you said there about people leaving and then, you know, cancelling their profile and so on. One of the standards that is also too is when a person resigns or whatever, they actually escort them out of the building. So on their last day, they actually nominate one of the managers or get security and whatever to actually escort that person from the building.
Yeah,
which is why you've usually done them over 2 weeks beforehand before they escort you out. But that's
right. It's silly. I've been escorted out of buildings, and I thought, it's not as if I couldn't have done anything nasty 2 weeks before.
Nah.
But it is a valid security precaution, and they do try to do it to stop people from doing things in the heat of anger. So the moral of that story is revenge is a dish best served cold. No, seriously. But yes, you can actually be exported from the building. But obviously plan your retreat if that's the sort of person you are, and we hope there's nobody like that in this class. But
there's no one here. I actually got retrenched from the company and I got escorted out, but I got on well with the boss, so I don't think she would have cared. Anyway.
Okay, also...
escorted me out. Anyway.
As a network administrator, you're going to be doing backups. We've talked a lot about doing backups on your own computer. It's very important that you're actually backing up information on the network. Again, you would be following whatever your guidelines are, but most places do backups every day at least. They can be used, done at the command line, so or from a batch file using the NT backup command.
Well, hopefully you'd be running something a bit better than NT backup though, especially because NT backup
on Linux.
That's because NT Backup does not back up an Exchange data store particularly well in its default configuration. And funnily enough, it's usually the Exchange data store you want when everything goes down and people want all their email folders that have been ferreting away for the past year and a half.
Is that because the Exchange store's locked? Does it have problems with locked files?
Yes, you actually have to execute various commands before and after the backup to lock and unlock the various databases that are involved. And even then, your backups aren't necessarily guaranteed to function.
Another vote for Linux.
Or OS X.
Okay, so now I can guarantee you'll have questions on this part in your exam. A full backup is a copy of all the files on the drive. An incremental backup backs up only those files created or changed since the last normal or incremental backup. So it marks the files as having been backed up. A differential backup copies files created or changed since the last normal or incremental backup, but it doesn't mark the files as having been backed up. Okay?
That's a differential one, is it?
Can you please tell me what is the difference between incremental and differential backup once again, please?
Yes, certainly. We will go over that because it's a very important point and it is in your test. So.
I'm just going to define the words so that might be easier, and then we'll go back over Geraldine's definition. Full, the lot, the works, with the onion and the tomato and the egg. It backs up everything, okay? Full. Increment. It backs up what was backed up since the last backup. So incremental numbers being 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So to restore a backup, you must restore the full backup and all of the incremental backups done since the last backup. And then differential is what has been done since the last backup, but it doesn't mark the files as being backed up, so you should be able to restore a full and the latest differential backup to get to where you are getting to.
Okay, so I'll just go over what I was saying again too. Thanks, Kerry, that's a good way to put it. A full backup
Hello?
Yeah?
For differential backup, we have to take again full backup?
A differential backup is what has been changed since the last full backup. You don't just do a differential backup. You have to at least have done one full backup beforehand. Otherwise, it won't be a differential backup by definition.
But in case of incremental backup, we again take backup from the last full backup, right?
Let's let Geraldine go through her stuff, and then I'll work us through an example of these.
Okay, I'll just reiterate what I said, because it really does cover what you're asking, I believe. So, and then Kerry can go, and if you've still got any questions, yeah, we will. Okay, a full backup. Now, as Kerry mentions, like the hamburger with the works, it's is a copy of all the files that are on the drive. An incremental backup backs up only those files that have been created or changed since you did the last normal or incremental backup. And it also marks the files as having been backed up. A differential backup copies the files that are created or changed since the last normal or incremental backup, but it doesn't mark the files as having been backed up. Okay, Kerry, you're...
Okay, now here's the example. Let's go through the example. FUBAR Consulting has a backup regime. And on Monday, Janice runs a full backup, Janice being the generic secretary that works for FUBAR. Okay. Monday, full backup. Everything gets backed up. Tuesday, incremental backup. Wednesday, incremental backup. Wednesday night, the server crashes. Okay? So to get back to where we were, we restore the Monday's full backup, we restore Tuesday's incremental, and then we restore Wednesday's incremental, and we're back but pretty much to where we were. Now, let's run a different scenario. FUBAR Consulting has just got a bigger tape drive. So on Monday, we run a full backup. On Tuesday, we run a differential backup, and Wednesday, we run a differential backup. Wednesday night, the server crashes. Wednesday is a bad day. We restore Monday's full backup and Wednesday's differential backup, so Monday's full and Wednesday's differential, and we are back to where we were. So we don't worry
about Tuesday's differential.
That's right, because by definition, the differential has the changes since the last full backup. So we restore one full and the latest differential, or one full and all of the incrementals with underlines and italics.
Yep, that's good, thanks.
Say if we done a full backup on Monday, Tuesday an incremental, Wednesday a differential.
Then you would restore the full backup from Monday and the differential backup from Wednesday, and you're fired for making the backup strategy too complex.
And you know what you should do, Kerry?
What's that?
If you can, I don't know whether you can work it out. Work out the time index of that little scenario, those two scenarios you've got it. When you make your web file, grab it out, put it up as a separate MP3, and it would be really, really cool for people. Because that was a brilliant explanation.
Yeah, no, I your question is valid, Attila, but if you're going to do differentials and incrementals and fulls all in the one backup strategy, you will confuse your IT staff, and you'd literally have to have a little calendar that would track what you're going to do. So decide whether it's full and incrementals or whether it's full and differentials, or buy some good enough backup software that'll manage it for you.
Okay, thanks.
I guess the other thing to keep in mind is that doing backups can take time, so scheduling in a time where you've got low network traffic is always a good idea too. Okay.
Those who are running Linux, and this is pointed at you, Elise, but other people may want to look at things like Amanda, A-M-A-N-D-A, which is the Automated Maryland Archival and something service. I can't remember what it all stands for. And also Bacula, B-A-C-U-L-A, which sucks the life data off your computers onto backup medium. And there are versions of Bacula for Windows.
Is that what's called Bacula?
Yes, that's why it's called Bacula. Oh,
Bacula, you're kidding.
And you can actually look at Amanda on, I think it's amanda.org, although somebody may have registered that for their girlfriend, so you may have to Google for it. And Bacula... that's Bacula.org. So you can look up Bacula, and there are Windows clients and servers for Bacula. And it's free.
I've just been using Async.
Yes, but Bacula's more powerful, especially once you get to things like incremental backups. Async will do exact copies, and with various fudgeries and symbolic links, you can do incremental file trees. But Bacula actually maintains catalogs and stuff and can actually tell you which media things are on if you're using removable media or DVDs.
Yeah,
so
yeah, gotcha.
Two different solutions to two different... Yeah, two different solutions to two different problems. But you can also look at rsync on rsync.samba.org, and it's free too.
Actually comes part as most recent Linux builds anyway.
And there are Windows versions. Although if you want to do that sort of stuff under Windows, you want a utility called RoboCopy. R-O-B-O-C-O-P-Y. And it's free too.
Cool.
Do review your notes on backups and try and make sure that before you do your ITE1 final exam that you really do know the differences between the backups, because I can guarantee you will have a question on it. Okay. And now I know during this course we have probably done to death troubleshooting, but we just want to briefly talk about some of the things with regard to network troubleshooting. And we've talked about using open-ended questions. So if we say, for example, talking to a customer about security errors, and we wanted to ask some open-ended question, you might be asking things like, obvious one is, when did the problem start? Also, if it's are there any network resources that you can access by wireless? What problems are they having? Those type of questions. Then you come into your things like your closed-ended questions. Do you have a firewall? Has anyone else used your computer? Now, that's a good one.
I think that was in one of the worksheets we did.
Yes, exactly. Obviously, too, you're going to be then, once you've identified the problem, verifying the obvious issues, using things like... verifying, does anyone else have this problem? Those type of questions can be used just to elucidate and further. There are a list of those type of questions in your notes, and I would advise you to have a look at those and sort of make yourself accountable or aware of them, type of questions you might use in that particular scenario. Okay, so once you've identified your problems and solutions, you're making a solution to the problem, and then don't forget the old documenting, all right? Because if you document the solution, the problem and the solution, that's going to help you if that happens again. Okay, so basically today we've talked a lot about computer security, why it's important to protect your computer, how to implement a security protocol, how to troubleshoot networks, and we've got a to the end of ITE 1, would you believe?
Yay!
It's gone very quickly, actually.
Congratulations on executing all the lectures, the pair of you, really well. Congratulations, both to you and Kerry, Geraldine.
Oh, thank you all. I'm sure we've both enjoyed it. It's been very good. Now, I guess the next few weeks is what we're going to be doing, is actually doing some revision of the modules for people... Well, for everybody, but you know, you can be doing your ITE finals whenever you like, of course, but it would be advisable if you wanted to sit in on the revision exercises. So,
well, the other thing I'd also point out is that if people have specific questions they can bring along to a lecture, that will make the revision far more targeted than if we just recap all of the modules in 2 minutes per lecture.